I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. Yeah, Rupda, it's really a delight to be with you. We just said, let's have some fun. I'm sure we're going to do that. How are you doing right now?
Good. Excited to be here, Joe. Thank you.
So yeah, we're going to be exploring the work you do, the transformational work you do around the world. Now you're traveling around the world. Let me introduce you first. Yeah, for those of you listening, Rupda is an internationally renowned trauma expert, personal development coach, and group facilitator with over 47 years of experience in self-awareness and personal growth. And her remarkable life journey from a childhood marked by abandonment and isolation to thriving within a spiritual community for 2 decades, and I think we'll talk about that a little bit today, that's shaped her into a compassionate and transformative leader in the field, dedicated to working with people's stories. Rupda helps individuals repair, resolve, and reconnect. And Rupda's blending somatic experiencing, trauma therapy, leadership development, spiritual practices, and creating powerful, nurturing spaces where resilience grows, authenticity thrives, and participants realize their fullest potential. And Rupda's mission is clear: to inspire transformation, foster deep connections, and remind everyone of their power to rewrite their stories and live authentically. True freedom, she believes, begins with reconnecting to our core selves. So that being said, we'll get to, in a sense, your philosophy of transformation. Like, what are you doing when you're holding these spaces for people? But I would love to ask you about how your childhood and upbringing has, you know, impacted you in terms of the work you do today. You had quite an unusual upbringing for most people growing up in a spiritual community. And could you say, you know, our podcast is not about that, but could you just say a little bit about what that was like? And in a sense, like, yeah, how did that What lessons came from that that do inform the work you do today?
We're going to go there. Let's do that. Okay, good. I think, you know, it started for me when I was 7 years old in the mid 70s. So, and I'm born in the 60s, and I think it's important to say the what happened before I entered that sort of spiritual world in the mid 70s and the impact that it had because of the contrast that I had before. And when I was born, I was given away at birth the first 9 months, and then my mother got me back, and you know, I think about 1.5, 2 years old on the streets of London, and someone had robbed her of her passport and her money, and it was winter time, and she had a nervous breakdown, just collapsed with this kid, this baby, you know, toddler, whatever, on her arms. And in that moment, the social services took me away for 6 months. And then by the time I got to 5, I was taken away to boarding school for a few years. And that was my biggest wounding, because I remember that. And that was in Oxford outside of London. And then I came back at 7. I say all that because the first 7 years, Joel, I didn't speak. I never had dialogue. I never had conversation. I was absolute nonverbal the first 7 years of my life. And now, looking back as a trauma therapist, I understand, because I was shocked out. I was traumatized. I saw things between age 2 and age 5, which no child should have ever seen in a home, and life-threatening, not only to myself, but to my only parent. And I somehow probably metabolized that in a very inner state of shock. And I don't think a little girl knows how to deal with that, to be honest, when you've been taken away so many times, what feels like abandonment. Yeah. So by the time 7 years old comes along, she luckily took me in the mid 70s, you know, back then everything was pulsing with revolution and emancipation, and the Beatles were growing their hair long, and everybody was talking about freedom. And, you know, she took me to a place in Scotland called Seni Ling, which is a Tibetan monastery. And I had my first direct experience with Tibetan Buddhist monks who also didn't speak English. But it was amazing, because everything again was in the nonverbal, which was perfect for me as a child in that realm. You know, right? It was in an inner world that hadn't yet been able to, capable to interact with the outer world. And they showed me compassion. They showed me, you know, love. They showed me meditation. We would sit every morning and do meditation at 6 a.m. when my mom was still sleeping, and I'd be sitting there, you know, singing mantras. I didn't even know what I was saying, you know. I didn't know what Om Mani Padme Hum meant, you know. But it was so beautiful. And then I got my first somatic registration of what it feels like to be safe, which was, of course, pivotal for me, because then I started to realize, this work is way much more than I, you know, this little girl could understand. She'd been in a boarding school age five to seven with kids at 10 years old and up. I was the only one at age 5 there. So I was hospitalized multiple times with stitches, and things happened to me that was not okay. I don't want to go into that for your listeners, but I want them to get the gravity of trauma that can be held in the 7 year old from birth to, you know, that age. And then the change and the shift that can start to happen when compassion and love and a kind of spiritual kind of realm of depth comes in. And it's hard to put my, you know, words on it, but I can say that that's when it started to really change.
Thank you for sharing so candidly. I imagine that we've met face to face, you know, and I know about the work you do in the world. So I really feel you've been on a radical journey of transformation around that trauma. So which I can imagine also gives you a great sense of what's possible and a great confidence in the possibility for transformation.
Yeah. And I know that when I do the work that I do today, if I just dip in a little bit in sharing with people what I've overcome, or let's say what I have managed to repair internally, you know, through this work, you know, I have to tell them, be very mindful not to compare your traumas with others. Otherwise, you end up minimizing yours. But what I'm trying to exemplify is that if someone with such a shocked out system, who might have been written off by, you know, many psychiatrists and trauma therapists, can come through, then that it's possible. And that's what I'm trying to, you know, kind of denote there. But the, of course, after what happened from in the Tibetan monastery, I was there for a couple of years, and then that really opened my mind. That really opened my awareness about what meditation is, and kind of landing and learning self-regulation, learning the foundation of that is so essential. And I can't say it enough for the Western culture. That's why meditation has been around for thousands of years. And if that was not enough, I guess there was a part of me that just was in that, just my brain was absorbing everything around that time period, because there was a lot going on in the 70s around personal development and spiritual growth. I jumped into a commune where I said to my mother, you know, by then I was so independent, you know, I barely lived with my mom. I said, can I go join a commune and an ashram and, you know, be, you know, in this very kind of, I don't know, spiritual environment, so to speak, that was doing meditation, was doing group therapy, was doing spiritual development and, you know, all sorts of stuff around working with the personal, the inner world, and how we, you know, learn how to communicate and connect, you know, not only with the outer, but the inner. And to my mother's credit, she said, yes, go for it, do it. And I changed my name and I, you know, changed the color of my clothes, and I became one of these people you would see on the street, look like a hippie little kid. But it wasn't so much about the outer that was essential for me. It was the inner, what was happening internally. My upbringing was on philosophy and on spirituality and was on, you know, awareness and meditation and, you know, learning how to deal with my inner state of being and my emotional landscape and all sorts of ways in connecting and interconnecting with others. And that was my upbringing. I didn't go to the conventional schools of education. I went to a really kind of personal development education, so to speak, growing up until my 20s. Yeah.
So, you know, I know you were in a community, this is the community you're describing, with quite a renowned mystical teacher. And I'm curious for you how you feel about the, you know, because some spiritual traditions can feel like they have a transcending quality to them, you know, if I think about some forms of Buddhism, it feels like it's about kind of getting off the wheel of samsara, you know, the cycle of life, and that the world is, you know, is a place where we get, you know, corrupted, or, there's full of desires and things that are going to co-opt us. And how was that for you in your community? What kind of work were you invited into, inner work?
There was definitely an element of what you're speaking to, which is letting go of the material world as an identity in what I do for a living, and being more turning in, so orientating from out to in. And I really did learn a lot about this this beautiful sentence that we know, to know thyself, yeah? And I started to learn about how I, in many ways in the trauma work, we call destabilized, and was very kind of disintegrated in my traumas. I didn't know how to interact in a way that most people might feel comfortable with. And yet, I wasn't a complete introvert, which was to my benefit. So I really extended myself to connect. But I needed to understand some of what was happening internally, like my emotional landscape. Why was I shut down, withdrawn? Why was I scared? Why was I, you know, going through different, you know, aspects of feelings with one or a group of individuals and not with another, and so on. And it, you know, and it continued like that in my development, of course, yeah. And there was a big piece around this spiritual teaching, let's say, which was the focus was to know thyself and was to let go of the need to have all this material stuff. The irony was that this person, my teacher, was very provocative in this area. And but I learned a lot. You know, I learned sitting in meditation. We sometimes meditated 2-3 hours in the morning and 2-3 hours in the evening. And as a child growing up into her teenage years and her adult years, that was a big backbone of learning how to develop inner strength, learning how to be at home in yourself, learning how to rely on self and self-soothe. And self-soothe has so much in there. You know, can I hold myself in a storm? Can I hold myself in my insecurities? And by the way, when you're abandoned and rejected as a child growing up, you're going to have that messaging, I'm not worthy of love, I'm damaged goods, I'm not wanted. So I'm working with that inner peace within myself. And if I interact with somebody and they get up from the table because they've got a meeting to go to, but I don't know they've got a meeting to go to, and they've just gotten up and left, and the wound will show, oh, I'm not worthy of their time, I don't matter, I'm not lovable. So learning how to handle the inner child work is so important. I discovered that because I rejected her because she was rejected. Yeah, I abandoned her because she was abandoned. And then, of course, that was my inner work in learning how to hold her, because I realized no relationship can hold her for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think is the relationship between kind of spiritual practice and more kind of traditional therapeutic or trauma therapies? Because on the one hand, it seems that, you know, you could meditate, and I've done this for years, and I've seen you can meditate for years, and then you get off the cushion, and then you know within 5 minutes you're triggered, you know, because someone annoyed you. And I think that's one of the benefits of not being a hermit, isn't being in the world, is like the world is a mirror, so everything is being reflected back to you, you know, as a gift to kind of begin to include. But so yeah, you on the tradition, so you know, meditation doesn't necessarily resolve our trauma and conditioning. And on the other hand, it seems that perhaps some traditional therapies could benefit from the kind of the disidentification from the wounding to meet the wounding with love, you know. And I know that's in there in some of these therapies, but like there's a kind of almost like coming from the light to heal the trauma. So where do you sit in that kind of spectrum, or like in a sense, really, I'm asking you like how you view what is the principle of healing for you and coming back to joy?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I first want to say that conventional therapy has done a lot of research on human behavior. So I have a deep respect for the data that they've collected over the decades of, you know, their research and development. Yeah. And they've also really helped in the world of mental health, you know, especially the way that they've approached it. I'm not a big fan on some of the things that conventional therapy can go into, especially if it's heavily medicating people. But I have also seen people go through periods of medication that has helped them come out of heavy, you know, clinical depression or anxiety. And I have a deep respect for that, because sometimes it needs that kind of time period just to pick us out or stabilize us so that we can do the next step, you know? So I'm in the, let's say, the edges of conventional therapy, because I'm a counselor, I'm a trauma therapist, it for me is still part of the circles of people I connect with, and we speak, of course, in that world together. My way of working includes that, but a big part of it also includes the body orientation. And the body, as well as, I don't know how far down the rabbit hole we go, but I work with the centers of intelligence. I often say this at the beginning of every leadership training or every retreat. And I work with four of them, one being the head center of intelligence, which of course is divided into the conscious and the unconscious, and the other being the heart center of intelligence, which has an amazing amount of intelligence. Now we're doing a lot of heart math work on how the heart registers sometimes in, you know, nanoseconds before the brain, and also the belly center, which is, I refer to the body, which the body has its own intelligence, and so much is coming out of that. And it's a big way of how I work. And then the fourth center of intelligence, which I love and work with, and it's not comfortable for some people, which is the unknown. And I believe that the unknown is the biggest center of intelligence, because it's the one that we are all sitting in, orbiting in, whether we, you know, agree to it or resist it. It is something we are in, and no one knows everything. And that step that I see when people take in the retreats or in the trainings is where I see the biggest transformations happen, because there's a let go in. There's a kind of the whole muscles relax into it. And so if you were to ask me, how do I work on a very simplification way, I would say to you, from the head down into the belly, then into the heart, and then towards something that is nothing to do with the therapist sitting in front of you anymore. Yeah, I might not say it like that in the beginning, but that's how I do it. And I do it with CEOs in companies to, you know, the refugees in Uganda. You know, I would go from every group of people. It's the same. You know, we all have these centers of intelligence.
Beautiful. I'd love to go all the way down the rabbit hole, full permission. Yeah, so
absolutely.
Could we give an example with that? Like, so, and that journey, you know, and I get that nothing's probably perfect and it's all nonlinear, but because when I hear that, what I interpret is like somebody comes in and first of all, through their conscious awareness, starts to get aware of some patterns, and then they're able to kind of include the emotional kind of compassion, you know, meet it, and then kind of really presence it in the body, and that, yeah. So what is that journey like? Yeah.
So yes, you're right. And with the head, when I get a group of people coming in, sitting in, you know, let's say I'm sitting with 40 people, they're all staring at me, and maybe I've got a few people already on board, you know, they're already seeing us smiling like you are now. Then there might be like half the room with their arms crossed, you know. I should actually take a really good example for you. I told you I was in Sigma, the international summit for, anyway, I was there in Valencia just a few weeks ago, and I had 400 people, mostly men, and mostly with their arms crossed. And they had just been listening to science and research, amazing data all day. And I'm at the end of the day. You know, so I don't get much time. Plus, I only get half an hour. We all got half an hour, yeah? And then they throw me out there at the very end, and I'm the only one who's coming in doing some personal development work. Everything, it was completely a switch of gear when I come out, yeah? And so I know in that moment when I'm standing there that I have to meet them first in the head. I have to get their understanding as to what I'm about to do and as to why we're going to be doing this work, or why we're going to enter a little bit deeper. So that part is opening their awareness, but it doesn't necessarily mean I get their agreement or their trust, but I'm more likely to get that when I placate to the area around consciousness and awareness. And so I already speak to that. But then I start to speak to that part of our what I refer to as the ego structure. Some people call it the saboteur. Some people call it the inner judge, the inner critic. We have many names for this. Freud talks about it, Jung talks about it, the shadow, and so on. Yeah. I refer to it as a name. I gave that part of that inner narrative that can be very negative and self-deprecating, and also can point the finger outwards. And, you know, that part that is like, it's almost like Lord of the Rings, that character, precious.
Oh yeah, Gollum.
Gollum, yeah, in my head, right? And usually people laugh and they get it and they go, and but all of us have that part on in our heads that is really hard on us, but in not in a nice way, and can sabotage us from the most intimate or joyful moments. So I need to speak to that part first, Joel. I need to get people to be aware of that personality structure that turned out to be an overachiever or a pleaser or a perfectionist, you know, or whatever part that it lives out in order to get love or to be seen or to create connection. Because internally the narrative is I'm not enough, yeah, or I'm not good enough. And it doesn't matter how high up on the material heap you stand, that narrative is still there, and even more so because they have to get even bigger bank accounts and bigger houses and bigger cars, you know, to fill the, you know, imaginary, you know, place. So I get that. And when I get that, and usually I work with a lot of playfulness, and I, you know, I'm not a trauma therapist that works with serious only. Like, of course, I'm very respectful for where people are at. But once I can get people's agreement and I feel a lightness start to open up, and I talk about, by the way, I'm going to name what I call my superego. Yeah. And please forgive me for those listening in your audience if it's their name. It was not intended. But I gave it the name Bruno. And Bruno is a mofo in the head that likes to just, you know, tell you you're not good enough. Right. So when I give people that understanding that we have that part of the brain that can be harsh, and then we have this other part of the brain that has awareness and consciousness, you know? Then what I do is I can slowly navigate into the body center, which is the intelligence of the body. And I often say it again and again, the body never lies. I asked everyone in that Sigma Summit to raise their hands who has tension in the body. 90% of the room raised their hand. And I said, I'm a woman, I'm 55 years old, and I have no tension in my body for over 25 years. And I have a lot of trauma in my life that I could be holding tension for, yeah? And I have a lot of different stresses because I'm constantly traveling, yeah? And going from one event to another. And you can feel everyone take a breath. And I said, so why do you guys think this is? And so I play a little bit with the body and how the body holds tension, but also can release tension. And Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote this beautiful book, The Body Keeps the Score, is a perfect example of that. We're holding and holding. So I get people to understand that around this piece around the body and what the body brings, of course, when we come into regulation and stabilization is presence. I can be here. It's safe to be here. It's safe to be here and to be a little bit more without my mask of I need to do more and be more and then I'm good enough. So now we have maybe a little bit of congruency happening between the head and the body being able to be present. Now, with your permission, we go a little bit to feeling. And I did this in 30 minutes. I had to do a real-time kind of piece, you know. And I just asked someone who would come up on the stage with me and work with me spontaneously and see if they would have the courage to say yes. I was very lucky. Hands went up. And to come to the heart center, to be vulnerable, and you and I know the value of vulnerability, it doesn't necessarily mean that people will go there in their daily lives, because it's a lot to be, because we've learned how to compartmentalize our feelings, our emotions, because maybe as a little child, we were told we were too much. So we became good little girls and good little boys. And it in a way was kind of to our detriment when it comes to the domain of feelings, because we then stopped many feelings that were dubbed not okay. I say all this because it impacts the way you relate with others as well as the way you relate to yourself. The biggest pieces around our shame and humiliation, who we think we are and who we think we should be. You know? But if people then start to come to the intelligence of the heart and start to open, even though it's scary and takes bravery, you find on the other side of what's happening in there is all of the jewels that we've ultimately been looking for, which is, of course, self-love, self-compassion, self-forgiveness, self-worth. And it starts to become, oh my God, the opening happens, the expansion happens. But this takes time, because some people have been numbing out for years. In fact, Joel, majority of people I'm working with is around depression or numbing out in different ways that people numb out, as we know, social media and alcohol and all sorts of things. So when people start to get feeling around it, and this is, again, it's not something we can intellectualize, a state of freedom or a state of expansion. It's just something they have to feel, yeah, felt sense. That's when the fourth intelligence comes in, and it, you know, it, that's kind of hard to put words on, because something starts to, they relax into, okay, not being always in control, not always having the answers, leaning into trust.
Beautiful, yeah. So the what's key for you in the metabolization of that trauma or conditioning? What ingredient supports someone moving from, you know, depression or numbed out to a kind of freedom and aliveness?
Well, you know, everything I say to you here is, in a way, it's simplified. And I do want to kind of underscore that for some people it might take really time to get there. And the steps might look different for different people in the sense of, you know, what they need to do. But what I've come to see, you know, I've worked with thousands of people around the world over decades. And what I've come to see is that if they can really come into that heart center, something starts to shift already there. And it's not a concept. It's not an intellectualized, it's not rationalized. That's quickly where the mind wants to go, yeah? To rationalize things, oh, I shouldn't feel that. That's not okay, yeah? I shouldn't be upset about this. You know, that's not okay. I shouldn't be hurt by this person. It's not okay. So we turn that tap off, so to speak. But we also turn that tap off to good feelings like expansion and joy and happiness and ecstasy and ecstaticness. We find pills to do that, you know? So, but the way I would suggest people to do, this is what helped me with the trauma work, Joel, is really to come somatically into the body. And there are different things we can do to start waking up the body. Beautiful thing with ecstatic dance and five rhythms is helping people come back into moving that body with music and different temperatures of the music and allowing a little catharsis or chaoticness so that, you know, it's not always in the box of how you're meant to be when it comes to dancing. But that loosens something up in the body. I take it a step further and I then bring in the element around feelings and allowing people to really express and explore different feelings, especially ones that we've kept locked down and in the basement and I'm never going there again because of a heartbreak or an abandonment or a rejection and so on. And those feelings I have come to realize have unlocked unlocks kind of uncomfortable feelings. I won't lie to you, yeah, because we have to face something that we don't often want to face. That's why I'd rather numb. But numbing for the next 20, 30 years is keeping you away from your true aliveness, yeah? Not false aliveness, not false joy, but true joy and aliveness. So it is a passage of going through uncomfortable feelings. And I do that through a real structure in the deep dive, for example, so that it's very much guided. Now, this mystical teacher that I was with said a quote about depression. And I have to say, it resonates with me. I don't know if clinical psychologists would agree. They might not see it in their textbook as fitting in the box. But what he said is, depression is anger without enthusiasm. And why I liked that is because when I work with people who have depression, and I'm very mindful, if it's really clinical depression, it's been going on for 8-10 years, and then I'm very mindful, of course, I'm in touch with whoever their practitioner is, if it's even right for them to come into something like the deep dive. But if it's a depression that they're passing through, and maybe it's, you know, been for a length of time, I then work through release work, not only somatic release work through the body, but emotional release work. And so that they can start to feel all of themselves again, not just part of themselves. Because remember this, Joel, part of what, we're not born with depression. Part of what happens early on in our childhood is we split off from parts of who we are to make it right for other people when we're young. So we split up from part of our, you know, when you look at a little kid who's 2 years old, they're expanded and enjoy. In fact, you put a bunch of kids that are like 2 years old in a sandbox, and within a matter of 1 hour, they might have gone through, I don't know, 20 emotions, crying, laughing, screaming, you know, giggling, whatever, running around, playing. They're full ecstatic of who they are. But then they learn to shut those things down, those feelings, because, you know, they're too much, or they need to slow down, or they need to calm down, or they need to be quiet. And in the UK, it was even not seen, you know? So they're really like, not myself only, it's a conditioning that we have in many cultures, not to be too much. And then when you learn that, and then you learn that if I get good grades, then I'm loved, or if I get good grades, then I'm seen. If I come home with a clean dress, then I'm, you know, perfect little girl. Then I get mommy's love. Then I get maybe a recognition. Then I'm seen. Then something happens, you know? And then we split off from that wildness, that too muchness, or that, you know, ecstatic playfulness. And we learn to kind of split off from parts of who we are, are where our joy originated from. And we conform in a way, in the way that also our conditioning is in the world today. And I don't think it's wrong behavior. It's survival. You know, it's a survival tactic. And by the way, I'm not even touching on any kind of emotional, verbal abuse or physical abuse, of course, sexual abuse that happens in many different environments growing up, or neglect or lack of presence and so on. When we go into there, that's a whole nother dimension of why people feel unsafe. And then they split off again from who they are. In order to feel safe, they become something. You know, we conform, we adjust. And sadly, we adapt to something that can be far away from our, you know, who we are. And then we feel sometimes very isolated and alone, you know, in the world. Where do I belong? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, this is a podcast, I think, you know, I'd say it's for coaches, but actually, I think what I'm most passionate about is being a transformational practitioner. Now, you know, a question we often get asked in our trainings is, you know, where's the boundary between therapy and coaching? And, you know, we're talking now about, yeah, this childhood conditioning that can come up, and even trauma, and that's been the realm of therapy. And of course, it's really important that coaches don't go to territories where they're not equipped and don't feel comfortable, you know, where they could do more harm. And yet, you know, what you're describing about the way we're conditioned and how then we adapt and take on roles which conform our energy and limit our aliveness, that's showing up inside of most coaching engagements too. It's the same dynamic that's alive inside of coaching executives, you know, or whoever you're working with. So, and I'm curious about, you know, what I've noticed is important when I'm working with clients is, that often they're kind of polarized inside of parts, you know, so there's a part that feels not enough, and then another part that doesn't like feeling not enough and saying you should be different, and maybe another part. And so they're kind of ping ponging around inside of all of those. And so it's important that they're able to disidentify and begin to notice those different parts, and then bring love and compassion. And really it's about letting them be, letting them feel seen just the way they are. And I found that to be like a really core principle. And so I'm getting to my question here, because, and I just want to weave in one more thing and then just see how you respond. It's like, I think a lot of coaching is like kind of trapped inside of a self-improvement paradigm. So in a way, it's like we're trying to get to that place where we're healed. We're trying to get to that place where we're confident, where we're more successful, where we're a better leader. But actually, in trying to do that, you step over the part of you that wants to be met. So this principle of like meet, you know, like dropping that change agenda and just meeting what's here with presence has been key. And I wonder for you, in your process facilitating, how much that resonates.
I love what you're saying, because the facilitation training is in teaching around presence. It's a big one, because like I said, you can be one of the C-suites that up there at the top of your game and feel so empty and hollow. In fact, we have depression up there. You know, we have loneliness up there. We have isolation up there. We have, that the biggest wounds still exist. And often the case is they want presence. They want someone to feel that, that someone cares, that they matter. Because one of the things that I sometimes share about is, different cases that I've had over the years. One woman stuck in my head, which was, she's one of the most biggest entrepreneurs in Romania. And she shared a story with me about when she was 7 years old. She said she had such a great relationship with her mother and father, but she heard down the hallway her father saying, "She'll never amount to anything." And it's a tradition that women get married and then you're happy if, you've got them sorted. But interestingly enough, that was the only wounding that she had from both of them, that she felt very much love from them. The irony is that she's now so successful trying to prove to her father that, see, I did amount to something. But her father's been dead for over 20 years. But that system in her cycle has not yet gone. It's like, that's the trauma response. I will show you, So that happens with a lot of overachievers, because they can't yet deal with that part of themselves that feels deficient or not good enough. And actually, when we meet it, just like you said, with compassion and love, we realize that it's the biggest lie that we've been telling ourselves, that we're not worthy. It's one of the biggest lies. It's not it's sad, because of course it's what we're working with, and I see some of the politicians today and I just see a wounded child inside, right? But it is what is driving these people, to prove the world, differently, check me out, I'm going to do this, I'm a mofo and I've got this, But so we're dealing with that personality structure, and underneath that is the longing to be seen, because what I often say in the facilitation training, you're right, it's not focused on therapy. The facilitation training is focused on how we hold people and how we support people moving forward in their life. But you're also correct by saying we need to know the backstory on this person. How do they come to be this way? It's not an accident. They didn't just, drop out of the sky like this. They came into form with this structure and they set up their life the way it is, and they're, disconnected or disassociated or for whatever reason, and some people are high functioning from that place, running companies, so how do we help them? Needs to have some reference in how they came to be, for sure. That's important. But by helping people to be stable and to be present, we also have to understand why we have that human need for that. And the biggest one is because the moment you're born, hopefully, and I don't know if this happened to everyone, is you're held in the arms of somebody. Usually it's a parent. And in that moment, you're seen. The parent is looking at the baby. Now, Freud talks about this place from the id state where we don't yet know ourselves we don't yet individuate from that time. We don't know who is the I. So the baby's looking at the parent in oneness, in that full frontal, lobe is expanded in oneness. That's why the baby's face is open and in pleasure and wide, wow, wonderment. And it's held. So two things are happening in that moment, contact and being seen and presence, actually three things, right? And it is priceless. That never goes away. And that's what I'm teaching people, not only in the deep dive, but in the facilitation training. That never goes away. It doesn't matter what age and how high up you are. So when I come back to these simple things of being present and letting someone really feel my presence, see me, let them see me, and then they feel seen. And sometimes, of course, I, with their permission, I ask, can I put my hand on your hand? Yes, and to feel. And sometimes I even say, can I give you a hug? And I embrace them. And the whole nervous system almost takes a breath. And it's like chocolate to the nervous system. I hold them and they just feel held. Because it's in our DNA. We're wired for that kind of holding and that kind of presence and that being seen. It relaxes that internal, I will prove the world, and that cycle, you know, that didn't actually settle. Yeah, that's trying to constantly get into the next and the next and the next goal. And that moment creates a deep relaxation. So that is a lot of what I'm working with when I'm supporting an individual. Of course, I'm working towards, you know, what follows, their joy, their career, what teams they're holding, and so on. But that's a big.
Yeah, thank you. So when you know, you talked about training facilitators, and we're talking about your work, I'm just curious to like zoom in when you're with somebody, like what's going on for you? What are you tracking? And I know that's a very broad question, because it may be that they're in very different stages of a process, but like what's guiding what you're tracking, and what kind of, you know, you've already named that you can maybe put your hand on someone, you give someone a hug, but what kind of moves do you find that you're commonly making with people?
Definitely recognition in the presence is a big one. Mm. Being heard is another one. Of course, people want to feel that they matter.
So do you mean like reflecting back, yes, that you're with them, yes, and that, exactly, you hear what they're saying, and yeah, it's, yes, fine. It's, and, like, and it's okay for them. Yeah, you're not judging them for that. Yeah,
exactly. And I echo back what they say often, and the questions that I ask are always framed in a way that supports connection, in a way that supports you know, kind of something that will inspire them. You know, I, you know, I'm very careful how I ask it. Contact is a big one, but I'm very respectful with the contact. So, and also slowing things down. So if somebody comes in, is got a lot of energy and they're very hyper and they're very jittery, one of the things I will do is slow down in my rhythm and see if their body matches my body. And I'm watching their body. They don't know that, but I don't usually tell them. I'm watching how they're breathing and where their eyes are going and their hands are going. I'm listening to the temperament of their voice and sort of key indicators, because the body never lies. If they're saying, yeah, 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 I'm relaxed, and their foot is jittery and they're all over the place, I can see that they're out of, you know, congruency then. I do want to say that when I'm coaching, depending of course if it's, you know, what kind of client it is, if corporate or outside of the corporate domain, because I get facilitators wanting to continue to get supervision as well, that part of my work is I'm heart-led. I work through the domain of the heart a lot. And so, of course, resonance is so important for me. And when people feel that resonance, I feel it does so much deeper work. So, for example, if people can start to feel you, you become feelable to them, but it also creates trust. It's the fastest way I know to gain trust. But that feeling is really important. So I orientate sometimes the questions towards, how do you notice it? How do you feel it? It's really for creating a connection in, when I work with, let's say, facilitators, because a lot of people who come to deep dives say, I want to do what you do. I want to be on the team. And they, because they see how I work very much in real time with feeling-oriented work, which is helping people to come into presence, helping people to get felt sense, helping people to notice when you're speaking about X, Y, Z, what's happening in your breathing, what's happening in your hands, what's happening when you're, you know, moving your head around, you know. I notice your left leg is shaking when you're talking about this, you know, client of yours or your co-founder or whatever it is. And so I get them to be aware of what's going on as they're in the middle of a coaching session. So, I mean, that when people see that happening in real time and then they see openings, I'm looking for access points. I'm looking for access points in their stories of the beliefs of who they think they are, where they think that they can't change. I'm looking for, you know, kind of breakpoints where we can change the way that they think and their behavior. But the biggest part that really does the work is when I can get those three centers engaged, then they're having an embodied experience. And when they're having an embodied experience, that's it. They have the realization. It's no longer about me guiding them, helping them. They're going, wow, I got it. I'm feeling it, I'm sensing it, and I'm aware of it. I got it. You know, that aha moment does so much more than me giving them, you know, more questions. You know, of course, I know how to get kind of access points and challenge them about, you know, if they're holding a team, let's say, or if they're holding a particular individual, or if they're just facing a life challenge in themselves. But getting them to have that full experience is way more than I can do in a textbook work, for example.
Yeah, I love this. This has been one of the topics on the podcast a lot, and I think is key to transformational coaching is working with what's arising in the present moment. You know, the coaching has to come out of just self-awareness and just conceptual awareness, just talking about things, into being in the living experience of the energetic conditioning, you know, that's come from our past, which, you know, we don't necessarily need to understand where it all came from, but there's actually more about meeting it as it arises in the moment. So like, as the coaching topic is being presenced, it's like, what is, yeah, how are you experiencing that right now? And so I'm wondering for you, you know, if you take that example of the high achieving CEO in Romania, you know, if they start to recognize like, oh yeah, I'm trying to prove myself to my father, and then they can feel the emotional tone, the shaping of that conditioning, and be present to it in the moment, you know, to start to feel, is it for you, it's about, they start to, first of all, it surfaces into their conscious awareness. And then secondly, they can be like, oh, I feel compassion towards that part of me, towards myself. And it's that kind of being aware of, and that compassion that then starts to create integration. Like, what's going on there for you? Is that, I mean, maybe that doesn't resonate with how I'm describing it. But
no, I imagine if we're aware that we're on the train of a story, a narrative that we're telling ourselves, in this case of that particular person proving to dad or being a high achiever, and then I'm worthy of love or being seen. And you're on that train, and that train's just going and going. And then you have the realization, holy crap, I realize I've been driving on that narrative, and it's been pushing me. Yeah, one way, great. But another way, I'm so disconnected from myself and who I am and who I think I should be has been running my life. And I'm so, who am I outside of this role and job and everything? And I can't even connect with my kids, and I can't even really feel big expansion moments with my children when they play, because I've just been driven and driven and driven and driven. Yeah. And then they realize they're on that narrative of that intense story and that train. And the moment they get the awareness, they can jump off the train. It might be a longer walk back to self, the self that is more in kind of balance with who they are and not split off from who they are, but integrated and more embracing their humanness. Yeah. But that's still that walk back is the journey. You know, it's the journey of more and more self-realization. Okay, this is not the truth of who I am, just to be ambitious and have the most money in the bank before I die. Because on your last breath, you're not going to be thinking about how much money I got on my bank. You know, you're going to be thinking about, what, did I spend time, quality time with myself and the people I love? Yeah. The other piece is that whatever is, as a coach, whatever is not resolved in you is going to show up in the field. If you can't handle feedback, if you can't handle being patient, if you can't handle, you know, empathy, if you can't handle certain human emotions, it's going to show up in the field. And this is why I often say, when I'm in the facilitation training, I ask the facilitators in training that they need to learn how to clean house, their internal house. They need to know all the rooms inside their own house if they're really going to support another in whatever. You never know. It might be, yes, a CEO coming, but you have no idea what room he's going to open up. And it might be uncomfortable. And can I be with the discomfort of that? In fact, not only that, can I help this person to really transform that? Do I have the tools and understanding in myself and how I do that, and how I navigate my own internal house so that I can truly be there for another? And this is, for me, very key in how you lead and guide and coach, because people can feel immediately that you can hold them, because you can hold yourself. You can hold yourself in weather, in whatever storm. And I'm a place in my life, I can hold so much now because of what I've been through. And it's important, because I needed to develop that. I needed to develop that whatever comes at me, can I hold myself in it? What's my resiliency? How long does it take me to come back? I needed to face depression. I needed to face anger. I needed to face my unworthiness, my vulnerability, all of it, in order to be able to hold whatever comes my way. And we are working with humans. The human factor never goes away when we're working with individuals in whatever environment, corporate or non-corporate. But that human factor is always there. And we're emotional beings. Even if we try to switch that tap off, you know, we have those feelings, you know? Yeah.
How do you teach, you know, how do you, I mean, I love that for a start, like everything's a mirror back to my own expansion, my own development. How do you teach facilitators to recognize when, you know, something's coming up and they're not able to hold it?
Well, I love what you said, Joel. The world is a mirror, because I often refer to that in relationships. I make a joke, if you think you're enlightened, just, you know, go spend a week with your ex or something, or your mother or someone, you know, and then let's see if you're enlightened. Because mirrors are happening all the time, and they point out to us what is resolved and repaired and what is still there, activated, charged, triggered, you know, with one little comment or, you know, behavior. And learning how to develop your inner container when you're not there yet is important. And by that, I mean, of course, meditation I use as a foundation, learning how to be with yourself, learning how to be with yourself and having an open dialogue with yourself. Every morning I say good morning to myself, and I say, hey, how are you doing, Rupta? What's your inner climate like today? You know, is it sunshine, rain, storm, whatever? And then I open up that conversation with myself. It might sound mad to the, you know, the average person, but it's getting to know myself, my needs, my, where am I, what, how do I need to self-care right now? What do I need in order to connect with somebody right now? What, why do I feel wobbly right now, shaky? And the more that I learn how to hold myself in developing my container, and by the way, when I say container, let's say it like this. I do a guided meditation sometimes, and I ask people to imagine you're in a sphere and you're sitting in that sphere, and first get them to really ground. Of course, there's a whole piece around being in the body and breathing and landing and feeling safe. And now imagining you're in the sphere, and that you put anything you want in that sphere. You can put your dog from when you were 7 years old in that sphere with you, and you can put your best friend from childhood in there. But you start to pack resources in that sphere, so you feel the kind of internal contentment of joy and love and connection. And it just creates something emotionally in you, but also somatically in you. Now this becomes your resource container. Yeah. And then I, after a while, I get people to really stack that up inside of themselves. And then I want them to, I get them to look at a life challenge that they're facing in their own lives, you know, and how they might be seeing that life challenge. Let's just hypothetically say that you're my partner, Joel, and you're leaving me, yeah, because you want to go to Jamaica and, you know, you're never coming back. And it brings up everything in me. Of course, it's going to bring up stuff in me. I'm human. But how I deal with that challenge, blaming you, making you wrong, putting you down, disgracing you, shaming you in public with our friends and doing all this kind of stuff because I'm wounded and abandoned and rejected. I could go in that direction. Of course, many people probably have done. Or I could go in the direction of conversations with you because I'm still haven't rejected myself. Even if I feel you rejecting me, I still haven't abandoned myself. Even if, you know, I feel you're abandoning me. I stay very in my container. And but this means I have to every day practice being with myself, holding myself. And if you can see my screen right now, I keep little Rukta on my phone every day is with me because this is right before I went to boarding school so that I don't abandon her, reject her and leave her. And this is part of one of those things I tell people, you know, keep a little photo of yourself in there. Remember that that freaked out little kid sometimes shows up. And it can be in the middle of a coaching session when you're giving coaching and that person can trick you with the same story of what happened to you. And then you need to stabilize yourself so that you can stay very grounded and present, but also feelable. And it will make your work go much deeper. Because you haven't switched off, you haven't shut down, you haven't withdrawn, you haven't been, you know, removed, passive. You're still very much present with them, but you're holding your own container. Yeah, does that make sense?
Totally. Like it's great. What I'm hearing is like some principles around what one is like. You know, the art of like including whatever arises, not making it wrong. You know, like if there is conflict with my partner or, you know, I'm feeling conflict with myself, you know, and then I start judging that as being wrong, then I'm adding to that kind of vibration of tension. So like the art of like learning to be self-aware and include on a subtler and subtler level what's here. And inside of that, really, like, you know, one of my teachers talks about, you know, life is a vibrational game, learning to master your vibration. So you know, the more you're able to do this integrative work and build this container, you're learning to kind of hold a space, you know, like a rooted, grounded, attuned, alive, whatever words feel right. But it's like, you know, you're coming in, you're enlivening yourself. And that joy that I've heard you refer to kind of can come forward. And it's an alivenment and a joy that isn't exclusive of other difficult, challenging things. And I really appreciate the way you talk about that. I think it's like, for me, that's one of the ways to mastery. Like if you're not doing that as a transformational coach or facilitator, you know, because like, and this is a question for you. And I also want to ask you about the unknown as well. It's like, you know, if you haven't met those frequencies within yourself, how can you see them and meet them within your clients? You know, and that's not to say that we need to be perfect, you know, like, because that's another, an interesting thing is like, you know, getting caught in the game of like forever cleaning up oneself before working with others. But well, let me stop there anyway and see what, if anything comes.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I just wanted to say that to add to that piece around facilitating and coaching others, how you do self-repair is really important. And so how do you do self-repair? And when you are realizing that you're maybe out of your depth or you feel shaky or disconnected, what helps you come back into connection? What helps you reassure or self-soothe? And you really, I highly recommend people to do kind of a roadmap back to self in what are the maybe top 5, 6, 7 ingredients that help you to stabilize or reconnect to self. And it might be some simple affirmations or a particular narrative or switching off the story you keep telling yourself to a story that is much more, you know, supportive and helps you to come back into center again. It might also be a movement, a shaking, a breath work, kind of a meditation resourcing. But these things are really important because they're, you know, personal development tools that help you self-repair to get you out of and off that train of, which is common in the coaching world, is the imposter syndrome, you know, who am I to be helping this person? You know, oh my God, what if they figure it out? You know, that can happen, you know. Say when you really are connected to self, that never comes. And it's, I don't know if I've really experienced it because all my work growing up has been around self in a way development. So I was actually resisting stepping into this work because I was just like, I'm constantly in it, you know, but it, I can understand if people aren't connected to self, that then yes, then you would feel like an imposter because you're not connected to self. It has nothing to do with the outer people are thinking of you. It's more that inner place. I would say.
What is self to you when you say connected to self? What do you mean by that?
Well, there's that we have these moments. You might have it when you're sitting in a vista in nature where you feel part of all in one and connected and not separate, where you feel when you close your eyes, you feel a warmth, an inner warmth, that where there might be a voice saying, you got this, or you're okay, or you feel a sense of calm and inner peace. And it just feels like nothing is lacking, nothing is deficient, that you're connected, you know? And that sense of self, actually in the deep dive, I often refer to it as your inner being. And we hear about it now more and more in mainstream. I was saying inner being in the 80s and people were looking at me like I was weird. So, and the inner being is really that, it's like coming home to yourself, you know, that place where, you know, it, let's say it's the part that we split off from. It's maybe the joyous, ecstatic, naughty, cheeky, playful, fun, but also inner, you know, free from the conditioned mind, free from how you meant to be in the world. You know, there's a certain, you know, it strips away all of the stories we keep telling ourselves and comes back to a very kind of a natural state of being where, you know, there's really nothing to do more or be more, because as you are, you know, you're kind of saying yes to that, you know. So, you know, that takes time because if you've got a lot of mental conditioning, and because of mental conditioning we have in the world today has created all sorts of OCDs and all sorts of different syndromes out there that I hesitate to go into, sadly, which the byproduct is panic attacks and anxieties and insomnia and depression. And we get all sorts of, really, it all starts from this overthinking mind, overanalyzing and, you know, piping down those, turning off the emotions and being so disconnected from self, you know, disconnected from our feelings. What do I feel right now? If I can't tell what I feel right now, how am I to know what I need right now? You know, they're interconnected, you know. And stepping in a bit now, if you want to go further in this, Joel, with the unknown, you know, what I have come to recognize with the unknown and that the mind that needs to control more, like, you know, control not only its mind, but also the body. You know, we control the body, we control people around us, loved ones, you know, we control our work environment, our home environment, usually tells me that it doesn't feel safe. And if it doesn't feel safe, it's not in a place of relaxation. And I often say, you know, our ability to relax in life is in direct proportion to our ability to trust. And to trust, for people to really trust, their trust has been damaged so many times, and they have, their mind is very good at keeping score and, you know, and then seeing evidence of where it might not be, you know, so where it might not be possible to trust, that we sabotage ourselves from really letting go into the trust, a deeper trust, which then takes us into trusting in that we're taken care of, trusting in the unknown, you know, trusting in the unknown. If I get a visual image of it, there was this beautiful painting done by a British artist a few hundred years ago, Ophelia, and she's just floating down the riverbanks, and she's let go of the riverbanks, and she's just allowing the water to take her. And it symbolizes to me letting go, surrender, and trust. And for the mind, there's like no freaking way. We have to get shit done. We have to do this. We have to do that. No way. I'm not going to trust this person, that person. And I don't mean to trust foolishly. I don't mean to just jump off a cliff and trust. What I mean is that I'm working with nervous systems in people's bodies that have created so much tension that they can't relax anymore. And it tells me that they've lost that connection to be able to really meet the unknown and relax and know that they're going to be taken care of, or to trust. The unknown just feels too vast and too big. And unknown for me, when I speak about it, is just to even just have a little bit of a moment in their life or in a day and say, okay, I'm going to go out and I don't know what's going to happen next. I'm going to go with this guy. I'm going to go on a date with this woman. I'm going to go do something, but I don't know what's going to happen next. And I'm going to give a little bit trust into the unknown, where you kind of titrate it, as we say in the formal work. Yeah, you just segment it step by step. Yeah, I'm going to trust a little bit more. I'm going to give this person a hug, and I'm going to trust that it's going to be okay. Or I'm going to go do something that I might not normally do. I'm going to go do karaoke. And I'm really, it's like, it's just stepping out of our comfort zone a bit. But that unknown develops a muscle inside of ourselves. And the muscle is trust. And when we go to trust at all, it changes our worldview. And it changes who we are and our relationship with ourselves. It's a deeper sense of freedom.
Yes, it's inspiring. It sounds like, in a way, like trust is a byproduct of, doing the integrative work that, because if you just say to someone, trust, you just need to trust, and they're like, okay, I'm going to trust, but they're just, that's an imposition, like they're a prescription layering over the top of the fear and the anxiety, then it's not going to land. But as one does that deeper integrative work and, they're metabolizing some of that conditioning, then, trust starts to emerge in the flow of life. And it sounds to me like, that's something I do with my clients, is we're working a lot with like what's arising in the moment, So it's a way of like, on a micro level, attuning to the unknown. It's like, as a coach, I'm like, I don't know where we're going to go in this session. That doesn't mean I don't know what I'm doing, or, that it's going to be kind of haphazard. No, there's a definite flow that we can follow and trust, but that it would be arrogant of me to know where we were going to go. And so we can practice that together, being in shared presence as things unfold and feeling the sense of, because I think that's where that aliveness and that joy really comes in, doesn't it?
And also when we learn that trust, we trust our intuition again, we trust our instincts again, we trust our decision making again, we trust the kind of choices that we make, the people that we decide to engage with or invest in, or whatever it is we're kind of meeting in our daily lives. And that trust, again, it comes back to that baby when you're being held, and the baby's body is completely in surrender mode, and it's in trust that it's going to be taken care of. It doesn't yet know mistrust, right? So it is in our DNA to want to trust, to feel safe, to feel like we belong. It's kind of foundational stuff. And when we lose ties to that foundational stuff, we start to feel that disconnection, and it does impact who we are as a human being. But if we learn as coaches how to do that by embodiment, we can teach people, but also we can guide people better too, because we trust our own instincts as well. We trust our own guidance and the words and the questions that come. I mean, sometimes I have no idea how I just, what came out of my head. I'm sure you've had these moments where you're in a supporting role and something just comes out of left field and you're like, wow, that sounded really good, So that's when we kind of land deeper in connection with who we are, or let's say with not having to effort, with not having to be something we're not, with not having to be alpha male or a dominating woman or anything, you know, or, you know, polished or performed, with just relaxing in the moment in who we are. And then I love what you keep saying, because I reference it just slightly different, but it's the same thing, Joel. I'm telling people when I'm often in deep dive, I say, I work with what's alive in the field. And if someone comes with a long application form around, let's say it's happened where someone hasn't talked about their sexual orientation and they've been ashamed because they've changed their interests. You know, now they don't want to be with their opposite sex. They want to be with the same sex. And they may never show up in the deep dive with talking about that particular topic. They may decide to talk about something completely different. So I'm working with what's alive in them. And that feels really true to form, because even if I see what's on the application form, it's not for me to, you know, direct them there. I'm more interested in what's happening right now, because that's what's, you know, that's what's cooking, you know, that's what's happening, that's what's alive. And so I'm glad you keep coming back to that. And I teach facilitators to follow that thread, you know, to, even if they come in with a whole bag of, you know, orange color things, and they, you end up talking about green color things because that's what's alive, go for it, you know?
Yeah, beautiful. As we come towards the end of our conversation, I guess a final question, which is maybe where we're at already, but what do you think is the important, how could I form this question? Like, I mean, maybe I'd put this, like, what would be the invitation you would make to someone who was wanting to really embody being a transformational practitioner for our times, you know, that these, you know, these, we're not in the world we were in 30 years ago. Like, we're at, the world has evolved and changed, and maybe that's inviting us as transformational practitioners to change and respond to serve the world. So what would be that, what would be, if anything, I mean, this whole conversation has been this, but what would be the invitation you might make to someone who is really committed to that path of, you know, being a masterful facilitator?
Yeah, I mean, of course, if you really want to step into this work and take it to a whole level of mastery, I would obviously want to have a love for working with human beings, you know, yeah, because, right, you know, the reality is you're really in that, you know, space with people, and that passion needs to be alive in you. And as much as you want to be out there helping other people, you need to include yourself in that journey. And so that's such an important key, because if you end up in the role of the helper, the pleaser, then it feels disingenuous, and it might show up, and you might end up really exhausted too if you don't know how to resource and self-regulate and your own boundaries around supporting others. I would also say that having a deep love for, you know, this inner work, inner growth, and being attuned to that inside yourself, staying, always keeping your finger on the pulse of where you're at, so that you can be honest with yourself about what's okay, what's not okay, as you support others. That's really important. And having a panoramic view of what is going on in the world today. What are people touched by? Because as a trauma therapist, I'm working with the collective trauma. I'm working with systemic trauma. I'm working with generational trauma. But it doesn't necessarily mean that coaches are, but it is in the field. When you're working with someone, you don't know what their background is. You don't know what they come from. So you're having a panoramic view with working with people. If you really want to get into the mastery of it, you know, I would really attune to not only, you know, yourself, but also to who's coming into your session room, or who you're going to go step into the office with. And, you know, the deeper inner work that you do is going to help on a transformational level way more than just a list of how-tos. How-tos are great. Don't get me wrong. You know, knowing how to self-soothe, knowing how to self-regulate, all these things, knowing how to guide others. And I do a whole list of that in my facilitation trainings. But what are they going to leave at the end of the day with? What is going to be the biggest hit is how you made them feel, right? So that is important because that continues. It's a continued journey, you know, how they feel.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. This has been a really rich conversation, Rupta. And yeah, just appreciating the journey you've been on and the dedication to this path. So that really shines through for me. And I'm wondering where people can find out more about your work. I know you're doing the deep dives around the world and you work one-on-one with clients. And yeah, where can we find out more about what you're up to?
Yeah, the deep dives, the last few are sold out. So, but you can still, I think there's a few more coming up next year for sure. The next one is also sold out. So, but if you go to rupda.com, R-U-P-D-A, .com/deep dive. If you go /deep dive, you'll see what deep dives we have, that are still available. And the facilitation training is happening October in Netherlands, October 2025. I mean, it will all be always ongoing, the facilitation training. We will do it in Latin America as well as in Europe each year. And if you want more details about that, I don't think it's on the website right now, but you can write info@rupta.com. And we can have a talk about what the facilitation training is about and see if it's right for you. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks again. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this, and it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.